This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and signature support comes from the good people at First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Your number again, 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And we start with Edward Ted James, former state lawmaker. He left his post at the Louisiana Capitol to join the Biden administration. He is a guru for small business at high levels in our country. And next week is Small Business Week. And we're going to talk with Ted about some politics near and far. But Representative James, good morning to you, sir.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
Doing well. How's the new gig going?
Look, I'm having fun, Jim, going all across the South Central region, making sure that we are continuing to help small businesses recover from the past 2 years and scale up with some of our traditional SBA programs, and really excited about National Small Business Week next week. Our SBA Business Person of the Year is from right here in Baton Rouge, so that's exciting. So next week we get to honor Craig Stevens and several other Louisiana businesses.
Well, small businesses are the backbone of our country. It is somewhat analogous to politics. Right now, for example, in Louisiana, the big cities in Louisiana are all Democratic strongholds, but yet the state is a Republican stronghold when we vote statewide because of the fact that the people in the rural areas are voting differently than those in the urban areas. But small businesses collectively, as you know, Ted, are a much bigger entity than big businesses, but yet quite often we focus on the big players in the world, and we sometimes neglect those who make the trains roll and make America great.
You're absolutely right. You know, small businesses create 2/3 of all net new jobs and employ, you know, half of the private workforce, and, you know, account for about 40% of our, you know, economic productivity as a country. So making sure that they have the resources that they need to succeed is largely why, you know, I took the job, as spent many years in the legislature advocating and pushing for the small guy, and, you know, absolutely excited about being at this agency where, you know, my advocacy now is in a totally different arena.
877-217-5757, your number for Ted James, and already have a question from a listener, and this is certainly applicable to people who work in small businesses. The GOP majority in the Labor Committee yesterday rejected four measures to increase Louisiana's minimum wage above $7.25 an hour. Ted James, your thoughts?
I do not have thoughts about what's going on in the legislature. Political things happening in the state are not things that I can discuss while I'm on the clock. So let's stick to the SBA and things that are impacting, you know, the things that I'm working on for the agency.
Well, maybe you can't discuss what happened at the legislature, but is a minimum wage of $7.25 appropriate?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's appropriate that we continue to put resources in the hands of small business owners. Whatever the legislature in Louisiana decides, whatever the United States Congress decides, my agency is going to have to pivot and make sure that their small businesses are able to keep their doors open. So no matter what the legislature decides or the Congress, we're going to be pushing to make sure that small businesses can stay afloat.
And as we know, some states have higher minimum wages. Arkansas is $11. Louisiana is $7.25. I don't know of any small businesses going out of business in Arkansas with an $11 minimum wage because of that. They may be going out of business for other reasons, but there are pressures on small businesses, and right now we know there are personnel issues. Is that a factor in today's world?
You know, there are a lot of pressures. You know, inflation, supply chain, human capital. Arkansas is in my region as well. I tell you, there are some great things happening in Arkansas. Louisiana is leading on some things. But, you know, as far as any type of new requirement, any type of, you know, mandate will be, you know, just another issue that small businesses are dealing with. And that's why we're focused on trying to educate them on all of our access to capital programs, our lending programs, to make sure that they're able to respond to whatever, you know, lawmakers deem appropriate for them to have to deal with.
Well, what is the biggest obstacle right now to small business?
Yeah, I think the biggest obstacle right now is the lack of access to capital for the smallest of small businesses, right? We are seeing, I think the Washington Post posted a couple weeks ago, banks are very reluctant to lend under $1 million right now. With PPP, the banks have probably had the strongest 2 years in probably the last 30 years. So we are still seeing a reluctance to lend to the smallest of small businesses. And what is so problematic for me is that in the last 2 years, we've seen about 5.6 million applications for new businesses. What the pandemic taught a lot of folks while they were sitting at home is that let's turn that idea into a business. So we're seeing more applications for small businesses in all states across the country. Most of those are being filed by women. So what we are seeing now is an access to capital issue for the smallest of small business, and that's what we're working on at the SBA.
877-217-5757 for Ted James, who thought long and hard. He survived COVID a few years ago, had a close call, and now he's working for the Biden administration as one of the big players in small business and works this particular region. How many states?
Five.
Five states.
I think Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, New Mexico, and Oklahoma.
Okay. David in Shenandoah. David, you're on Talk Louisiana with Ted James.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Mr. James, you feel that the legislature should look at possibly for the pay raises having some type of aspect where it associates with the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and how would that affect the situation?
All right. We haven't had a minimum wage increase in a long time, and there has been, as we know, inflation, and some believe it should be adjusted for inflation. Would that be a practical way to approach it?
You know, for me, I have no opinion on what's happening at the legislature. I want to say that several times. You know, the Ted James that used to come on this show can answer some of those questions. Right now, I can't answer about my opinions about what's happening at the legislature. But I will tell you that small businesses are hurting for a variety of issues. And what I recognize is important about the Small Business Administration is that we have enjoyed bipartisan support in the Congress to make sure that we have programs so small businesses can mm-hmm. respond and pivot. Chief among those is, you know, the billions of dollars that we've put out with our COVID IDLE, restaurant revitalization, shutter venue, and those issues were issues that both sides of the aisle recognize as important. And as we are coming, I don't see that Congress is probably going to appropriate any more COVID aid. So now we are focusing on those traditional SBA programs, be it, you know, the counseling that we have at all of our small business development centers across the state. We have 10 in Louisiana, access to capital. And the most important thing for the small businesses that have been thriving is to make sure that they have access to federal contracts. With the bipartisan infrastructure bill, this is a huge opportunity for Louisiana businesses to participate with all of the projects that we have coming to our great state.
Clayton on Essen. Clayton, you're on with Ted James.
Good morning. So I have two comments here. I'm a small business owner myself. I'm a home inspector. If a small business can't afford to pay a living wage, then they can't afford to be in business. $7.25 is not a living wage. And I pay a tremendous amount in taxes. And so it is not fair to me when big competitors of mine, big players in town, pay much lower percentage in taxes.
All right. That's a good point, Clayton. Thank you, Representative James. There are some, as we know, some big players in business who are not small business owners, who don't pay any taxes, and yet there are people like Clayton who pay a lot of taxes. Is that something that is a disparity that can be addressed?
Yeah, I think that, you know, based on the history of this state, that concern needs to be placed at the hands of folks down at the state capitol. It is a concern that I've heard from several small business owners, the disparity in our tax structure from, you know, the smallest of small business to the big guys. So You know, of course, I think that it's something that can be addressed. Now, whether there's the will to address it, that's another question.
877-217-5757 in our time with Ted James, Patrick in Ennis-Wald Estates. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, I got a question about Cedric Richmond. I mean, if it wasn't for him, I don't think Biden would be president. But yet he's jumping ship. Could you give us any input on what's going on there? Why is he leaving the Biden administration?
All right. Ted, we're about to go to a break, but do you know anything?
I know what I read, and that he's going to be helping with the midterm election. So I think that his new position is only going to strengthen the Biden administration if the Biden administration is going to continue to be successful.
All right. We do have to take a break, but we'll pick it up with Ted James. And we invite you to call 877-217-5757. We're back with more Talk Louisiana in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Former State Representative Ted James is in the House. He's working as the head of small business for five states under President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. 877-217-5757. Before we go back to the phones, Patrick asked about Cedric Richmond. You know him well, a man who accomplished great things, had the president's ear as his chief advisor in the West Wing. Heady stuff, now leaving to work on campaigns, and he's quoted in some books, or a book, of making some inflammatory statements about others, including AOC, but that's a tough job in the West Wing, isn't it? Lots of power, but a tough job.
Yeah, I would imagine that it is an extremely difficult job, especially in this climate. You know, I don't see it as Cedric jumping ship. I see it as him moving into a different direction to make sure the ship stays moving in the right direction. And, you know, I wish him well, of course. I want to see, you know, of course, this administration, which I'm a part of, I want to see us continue to do well.
Betty in Mid-City. Betty, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, everyone. I'd just like to make a comment about the small business, small businesses. I agree with the previous caller that said something about the taxes for big businesses, but a minimum wage is not enough. It used to be at a time when minimum wage was for college students and children, you know, young of age, trying to just earn earn a wage for minimal reasons. But for a family trying to take care of a family in a home, minimum wage is not enough. And Ted James, I would like to see you advocate for that because small businesses, is like the previous caller said, if you can't afford to pay somebody to work, then you don't need to be in business because one thing we know, once the money is there, we generate it back into the economy, and the economy thrives.
All right. Thank you, Betty. Very sincere person, Ted James. I'm sure you hear people. You heard a lot of people like Betty when you were a state lawmaker. You're wearing a different hat now, but do you, as the words of a former president would say, do you feel her pain?
Oh, I definitely do. And, you know, in a former life, I was a very loud voice for that exact issue. Right now, I am not in the advocate position, and I'm not in the policy-making position. So whatever the policies are, I have to implement those. But, you know, I certainly feel her pain coming from a family. I hear from small businesses every single day. I hear from small businesses that have that pay their employees $15 an hour, and they're doing well. I hear from small businesses who struggle to pay the $7.25. So not only do I hear her pain, I hear the pain of the business owners as well. That's why I'm working extremely hard to make sure that we are, you know, closing out our COVID recovery programs to make sure that those small businesses that were impacted can take advantage of, you know, the increase in COVID idle that we just put out, and also making sure that the smallest of small businesses know about our resources. Because that's one thing, of course. You know, I've learned so much in the last, I think, 90 days. You know, I never met the regional administrator in my 10 years in the legislature. So had I known a lot of the programs that I administer now, I could have helped a lot of businesses over the past 10 years. So my charge now is to make sure that no matter what the Congress or the state legislature passes, that we're making sure that businesses can mm-hmm. grow, expand, and pivot.
All right. A listener, Holly in the Garden District, asks about how crime affects small business. Can you imagine right now, for example, running a small business in certain parts of Baton Rouge has to be a bit of a challenge when people are fearful of their lives when they walk down the street. And in some streets, that is a real concern. Ted, your thoughts?
You know, everything that impacts the community impacts a small business. Crime, climate change, all those different things impact small businesses. One of the programs that we just put out is to help businesses stand up the infrastructure for security, for, you know, increased broadband coverage, to make sure that your cameras are operable, to make sure that you can communicate with your customers virtually. So, you know, crime, climate change, all those things impact small businesses.
Now, here's a observation presented to you from Owen on Highland, saying that our junior senator, John Neely Kennedy, grilled Attorney General Merrick Garland on crime recently, as in this week, calling Chicago the world's outdoor shooting range, world's largest outdoor shooting range. Now, they've got problems in Chicago, but on a per capita basis, we have bigger problems in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Why would Senator Kennedy, ask Owen, pick on poor Chicago when he is representing the good people of Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and Louisiana has the highest murder rate in America for 33 straight years? Why is that the case?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a question for the senator. I do know that the senator has supported several issues that we've advocated for at the SBA, as the senator is on the Small Business Committee. So you have to ask him about his comments.
All right, what about redistricting? Louisiana overturned the governor, the legislature did. I suspect if you had been there, you would have voted to uphold the governor's veto, but did they make the right call?
I think that's safe to say.
Yeah.
You know, if I can imagine, if I had a crystal ball, Representative James would have been on the side of repealing.
Repealing, you would have wanted a different lineup.
I would have wanted a different map. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. We've got the same one, and essentially, and that means that there's only one opportunity for a black or a Democrat, for that matter, to be elected in Louisiana. And the state is a Republican stronghold, but it's not 5-1 Republican. So is that reflective of the state's wishes?
You know, I think that the state has a very rich opportunity at the moment. You know, we have been considered a red state, but we have some heavy hitters that are working in federal government, from Cedric to former mayor Mitch Landrieu, and we have a really golden opportunity, no matter what the maps look like, to ensure that the Louisiana businesses can contract with the federal government in every single congressional district. And, you know, for me, regardless of what the maps look like, we have a mandate to make sure that we at least have equity in spending, and that's why I'm so excited about the Biden administration, because we prioritize equity and spending for the smallest of small businesses, increasing the statutory goal of from 5% to 11%, to make sure that as we put out all of these projects with the bipartisan infrastructure law, that Louisiana small businesses have an opportunity to compete. So mm-hmm. I'll be traveling all through all of the congressional districts, making sure that, number one, our small businesses know about the certification so that they are able and ready to take on these jobs when they start coming to the great state. And it's very important when you talk about Cedric, you talk about Mitch, you also have to talk about Senator Cassidy, who was instrumental in making sure that Louisiana had a seat at the table. And I don't have to tell you, but usually in presidential politics, Louisiana goes unnoticed. But in this administration, we have some key folks in key places. And this is, I believe, the right time for Louisiana to really take advantage of this huge opportunity we have, because Louisiana is certainly punching above its weight at the federal government right now.
Now, right now, of course, politics is divisive, more so than ever, and we hear this mantra that there is massive inflation, and there is, but also we have a growth in the United States that is quite profound at this point. Are we overlooking the positives and accenting the negatives, or is there a real concern that inflation is going to drag us down?
You know, I think that it's certainly a concern, right? I hear it every day from small businesses, but I also hear success stories, right? I hear how businesses are thriving. It's no secret that the when you look at inflation, it's hurting every single person. The president recognized that. The president has put out several different initiatives to try to address that. But we have also had the largest growth in our country's history, right? We can't ignore that when we look at...
Well, we do have to roll, but thank you, Ted James. Congrats on your new position. And when we return, we'll hear from the remarkable Denny McClain. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased you're with us. And one of our favorite guests, Dennis Dale McClain, the man who was the top pitcher in baseball in the late 1960s and came in an era in which people were born between 1943 and 45. You think of the great pitchers, Jim Palmer, Tom Seaver, Steve Carlton, Don Sutton, Andy Messersmith, Fergie Jenkins, and Denny McClain, all really once-in-a-generation talents, and they all pitched at the same time. And in 1968 and 69, Mr. McClain won 55 games in 2 years and two Cy Young Awards, an MVP, and a world championship. And he is with us, as usual, to talk about then and now. And let's get to Clayton Kershaw, probably the best pitcher of his generation, who a few days ago pitched seven innings of perfect ball, 13 strikeouts, 80 pitches, and left the game. Denny McClain, that would be heresy in your day, but Kershaw's protecting his arm. What do you think?
Well, I don't think he was protecting his arm. I think he was placating the manager and everybody else who wanted to. I don't think people – listen, I played in a very difficult environment in Detroit. A lot of guys, when you were successful, did not like you being successful. And you know why? I'll tell you why, because people have a little hard time understanding. Because when you're out on that mound or you're in the infield or you're hitting the bat, you are competing against not only the rest of the league and the other league, but you're competing against your own guys. If you go 0 for 20, 0 for 30, you're on your way down to Timbuktu or Chinatown or Guam, or you pick it, you're gone. And so I think that's one of the reasons people like to see some of that hit the wall. And certainly it has. But this thing in L.A., I just still don't believe it. I just, God, the guy's got a, not only does he have a no-hitter going, perfect game, but he's only throwing 80-some pitches. That's it. 80-some pitches, I think. Seven. So in the worst-case scenario, he's still got 20 pitches to go in the perfect world. If he doesn't, maybe he's got 30, but he's still going to be 100, 110 at the most. And I just thought it was Bush of the manager to do that. And number two, again, that the way he handled it, I don't think he handled it well. And I'm sure Clayton had an awful lot to say behind the mic without any, you know, without any repercussions. So he's a good pitcher, probably one of the best we've ever seen in Major League Baseball. He knows what he's doing. He's a smart guy too, by the way. And you know, it's just fun to watch a guy like that pitch. There's certain guys I watch to pitch. Scherzer, who's not doing so well right now, who I think has got the greatest stuff I've seen in 30 or 40 years. And then there's a couple of other guys, but there aren't very many Scherzers and left-handers in L.A. anymore. They just aren't. Look what they do in Tampa. They have a starter, or they have a relief pitcher start a game. And then vice versa, whatever the hell they're doing down there. But I guess what? It works.
Well, you pitched, as I've noted, 336 innings in 1 year and then 325 the next when you were 24 and 25 years old. And, of course, you ended up having arm problems. Scherzer and Kershaw are now in their mid-30s, and they're still going strong. And is it because they didn't have the wear and tear that you did?
Well, they both had operations so far. You know that, right?
Yes.
So That's something we didn't have. What we had was, we had the best stuff in the world. Cortisone and hot water. Now, does that sound like the most sophisticated stuff in the world? And yet that's what Kofax used. That's what Drysdale used. Marichal used. We all used the same thing. There wasn't anything else. I mean, back then, unless I'm the dumbest son of a gun in the world, and I may well be, by the way, I'd be one of the candidates. But the thing about it is that guys were not into drugs at that point. They weren't doing drugs. Whatever was on our training table, that's what they said was allowed by major league rules and what have you. Who are we to doubt what they were actually putting on the table? Because we now know, of course, there were funny pills on that table too. And the guy who lived on them was Norm Cash. I mean, I don't think Cash had real food for the entire summer. I think he just ate those pills all the time and ate lots of them because he was not. Listen, when you go up the home plate with a piano leg that you're going to use to hit off Nolan Ryan, something wrong with them pills you're taking.
And Norm Cash did that. Now,
he did it.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, Hoyt Wilhelm did a commercial for Bengay ointment. Uh-huh. Did you use Bengay, Denny McClain?
No, but I do know a number of guys, including Emmett Ashford, the great umpire in the American League with us, first black umpire. He had a great case of hemorrhoids. Now, I didn't see him, thank God, but one of our guys, Don McMahon, was pitching in relief. And somebody said, as McMahon walked by home plate to go to the mound, Bill Freehan turned and said, "What the hell does that smell, Emmett? You sick?" And Emmett said, "No, I'm not sick. What are you talking about sick?" He says, "I smell something, and I know what that is." He says, "No, you don't." He says, "Now, I might know what it is." He says, "But you don't. You're not old enough." So they started to warm up a little bit, and then Emmett finally said, "Hey, hang on, everybody. Hang on. We're going to find out right now." He called John Wyatt down into the box and said to John, "Do you have a foreign substance on your body?" He says, "What part of my body, John?"
It was Preparation H, wasn't it?
So, because the home plate umpire said to Wyatt, he says, because Wyatt, he threw Wyatt out of the game because he found all this stuff on him. So Wyatt threw his bat up in the air about 40, 50 feet, and John and Emmett looked up at the bat, looked down at John, and said, "If that bat comes down, you will no longer play today." That was it.
He was caught with Preparation H, which used to be something that pitchers used to rub up the ball.
And you know what else? And if somebody lit a match around him, we'd have had to call the fire department.
Now, a listener, David in St. Francisville, said, "Should we have a pitching clock? Now the games are longer. No. Sometimes these guys are taking 45 seconds between a pitch. What do you think?"
Nah, let's play the game. I mean, we played with too many toys the last couple of years. Between the pandemic and guys getting it and having not to be able to play and things like that. No, let's play the game again. Get the damn guy off second base. Let's not play, because I'm telling you what's coming. The commissioner, if this guy lasts much longer, I'm going to be surprised. I really liked him when he came up, as you may recall. But I'm going to tell you, he was just innovative, creative. And now all of a sudden he puts a man on second. He wants to put a man on first. He wants to make the base 3 feet by 3 feet, something like that. I mean, come on. I mean, where does this stop? And I'll tell you where it stops. When you don't see an umpire behind home plate anymore, it has started. And that would destroy the game, putting a radar system, a ground-seeking system in that would call balls and strikes. That just can't happen. You know, right now you can't argue with anybody. I mean, it wasn't going to the ballpark, wasn't that part of the entertainment value? Billy Martin kicking dirt on Yogi Berra, Yogi Berra kicking this. I mean, we don't have that anymore. Everybody's counting their money. As soon as the game's over, people go back and check their balances.
Yeah, it is amazing the money these guys are making. We're talking mediocre players, too. But
unbelievable. You're absolutely right.
DH, the universal DH. Do you like it?
Yeah, I've always liked the DH, but I just thought they misplayed it. Everybody should have been using the DH all those years, because the American League and the World Series, we're at a real distinct disadvantage, unless we're using lots of pinch hitters. I think that's a good thing. I really do. No pitcher, well, all pitchers would like to pitch against another pitcher. I mean, no question about it. But then you've got nine hitters in the lineup. That's a whole different ballgame. And so you got to concentrate on every guy. You know, these guys, I heard something yesterday coming in on the radio, and it said, well, this guy now, man, what a game he pitched last night down in Toledo. Now, listen, Toledo, not Chicago, New York, Houston, none of those cities. What a game he pitched last night. He struck out eight guys in five innings. And I'm thinking, well, six of them will never see the major leagues unless they buy a ticket. And they're raving like this is the next Cy Young. I mean, our broadcasters in Detroit have gone way over the top. I mean, and I think we've lost like 100 in a row again. So we don't. Yesterday we made, I think, four errors in one inning. Four, and two of them were bunts. How the hell do you make two errors on two bunts?
Well, it happens. Remember, Willie Davis made three errors in the same inning in the 66 World Series in Sandy Koufax.
Yeah, but we don't talk about the old guys making mistakes.
No, they didn't make any. But the game was different, and you played for different reasons, and most of you had jobs in the off season. Now, you were an accomplished pianist and an organist. How did that happen?
Well, once I was on the target for 30 wins, Hammond Organ Piano Company come and saw me and said, we'll do this with you for a number of years. You name the years and we'll pay you for that period of time. But you have to tour every year at least. But you got to do at least 30 to 50 stops a year playing the Hammond. I said, hell, that's easy. So as long as they move the Hammond around. So that's the deal we did. I did that for 20-some years, 26, 27 years. I mean, listen, I was the only guy in baseball that knew I had a job in the winter. Guys were selling cars, selling Triple H. I don't know. They were selling anything they could sell, working in factories, reps for the factories and things like that.
We're going to have to take a short break, but we will return with Denny McLean for a few more moments. The remarkable man who is the last, and probably he'll be the last forever, to win 30 games in a season. He won 31 in 1968, followed up with 24 in 69, and we'll be back with Dennis Dale McLean after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. We're spending a few more minutes with Denny McLean. Made it to the major leagues when he was 19 years old in 1963, Oak Park, Illinois. They didn't have a major league draft in those days. And a listener asked a good question, Denny. When did you know you were special? When did you know you were cut above the other guys?
I was 64. I had been on a disabled list for most of the year before, and because of my rotator cuff at 19, 20. And so I pitched with that the rest of my career. But here was when I learned. So they sent me out in the middle of a game. We were down three runs, four runs, and said, here, you finish this game up. He says, we don't have anybody else we want to throw in there. So I was the last guy in the totem pole. That's what it was telling me. And I better keep my bag warm. So I went out there and struck out seven in a row. And as they say, the rest is history. All of a sudden, I was the number one or two guy in the rotation. And that year wound up winning 16 games, which also proves one other thing. Give a guy enough of a chance and something good can really happen up there.
Yeah, and you won 16 games when you were, 20 years old?
Yeah.
And then the next year you started in the Major League All-Star game against one Sandy Koufax.
Yes, sirree, and I still joke with him about it. I said, you know, I beat you in the 66 World Series. He says, how many times are you going to tell me that? He says, I don't want to hear it anymore. I said, I don't think I told you in the last year. And, you know, we get chuckles out of it pretty good. But let me tell you, I always thought that he had the best stuff I ever saw. But I've changed my mind, as I said earlier. it's Scherzer. I mean, he may be losing it right now, but I want to tell you something. Nobody's got his stuff. The guy could pitch 9 innings throwing the ball down the middle and not give up a run and possibly a hit. That's the kind of stuff he has. The ball moves all the time. All the time. And that's the toughest guy to catch, but it's also the most fun time you'll ever have playing behind a pitcher.
Well, he is a guy who pitched in Detroit.
He sure did. He
pitched in Washington. And in go ahead.
Do you realize we had 4 Cy Young Award winners on our team at one time?
In Detroit.
And then all of a sudden, Ilitch, the kid in his divine wisdom, decided to get rid of 2 or 3 of them at the same time. Why would you take the best pitching staff maybe baseball's ever seen, and lo and behold, he gets rid of everybody in a New York second? I mean, it was that quick. So we don't have much of a head of the ball club right now. They're pizza people. That's what they are. And they're great pizza people. They do that job better than any major league team probably does baseball. But you know what? You got to stay out of the things you really don't know. Mm-hmm. Don't make yourself an expert on a sport that you barely could pick up a ground ball when you were 15 years old.
Well, lastly, a listener asked why you never managed. And as you know firsthand, if you're a great player, sometimes you're not a very good manager, as Ted Williams, who was the greatest hitter of them all. He was a terrible manager, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was just terrible. Not a nice person. He had his days. He, by the way, he met his last wife by putting his cowboy boots underneath their butt in the first class section of the airline. That's the kind of guy Ted was. As far as managing, I had 3 or 4 offers to manage, and I turned them all down. They didn't pay any money. I mean, I had 4 children, and I'm supposed to manage these kids all over the country for $35,000 a year? It's impossible. I mean, and we're still going in a AAA location. You're going into some pretty expensive cities. So it would have been very tough. On top of that, remember, I had the 2 things going for me, Pepsi and Hammond. it was never a big deal with me.
And you still drink Pepsis all these years, right?
I don't drink like I used to because I just had a heart attack about 6-7 weeks ago.
I did not
and,
know.
And then I've got a seeping left lung pouring into the right lung, which they're taking care of. I'm not worried about that. But I've had AFib for 30-some years, and it's okay. I'm fine. But the heart attack just stunned all of us. And I had the heart attack. You want to talk about what a great life I've had up until when I lost my baby, my wife, Sharon. I had the heart attack in the doctor's office.
Well, that's a good place if you're going to have one to have it. And I'm glad you got
good
medical
care. That's good preparation, isn't it?
It is indeed. Denny, we're glad you're in the game. Love you and keep going, and it's always an honor.
I'm coming down there in a couple of weeks. I will look you up and save some money for lunch.
We'll do it. Thank you, Denny McClain.
All right.
Appreciate you. Sayantani Dasgupta is our guest to close out the hour, a physician and author of Indian Heritage. Her latest work is Debating Darcy. She's a fascinating person, born in the great city of Columbus, Ohio, and educated at Brown University, Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And good morning to you, Sayantani Dasgupta.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to hear your voice. And you share a couple of things with our former governor, who is of Hindi and heritage and went to Brown University, Bobby Jindal. And you're about the same age.
We were in the same class.
Were you really?
I knew him. Yeah, exactly. Yep, we were. We were in the same class. And I definitely knew him when I was at Brown.
Was he a nice guy or was he a jerk?
No, he was a nice guy.
He's a nice man. He's those of us who have had disagreements with him politically, he is a nice, nice man. And I find that, I hate to generalize. It's always dangerous. But all Indian Americans I have met are all nice people.
Well, the, I'm sure that there are the not nice among us. But I'm glad that you've had a good experience.
Well, yes. And you have had this fantastic career as a writer, but as mentioned, you're also a physician. Those two don't always go together. How have you combined your pursuits in such varied ways?
Well, you know, Jim, I clearly don't know what I want to be when I grow up, so I keep changing careers. But I really feel like being a physician, you know, particularly a pediatrician taking care of kids, and being a storyteller aren't really that dissimilar, because I think that, you know, doctors spend their days listening to stories. And if they're good doctors, they listen really well, right? They make you feel like they're right there with you. I was just hearing your last guest. So, you know, at a moment of crisis, like a heart attack, you need somebody to really be there with you, to witness what you're going through, to listen to your concerns. And that's all storytelling skill. So I think that the reason there's so many doctors who also end up writing is because we share that skill set. You know, we're storytellers and story listeners. And to be a writer, obviously, you need to know how to do that as well.
Well, the latest from Sayantani Desgupta is Debating Darcy. And this is a reimagination of the beloved classic Pride and Prejudice. Can you tell us more?
It is. So I am a huge Jane Austen fan. I've read and reread Pride and Prejudice since I was a little girl, you know, endless numbers of times. I've seen all the movies, you know, the whole deal. But of course, you know, I never got to see a character like me in this beloved story. And so I thought, well, the original book, yes, it's about romance and froth and, you know, a man and a woman falling in love, but it's also really about wit. It's about, you know, a couple that debates their way into falling in love. And so it made sense to me to set my reimagining in kind of what we're calling the high stakes world of high school speech and debate. So it's about, yeah, it's about a character, Lila Bose, who goes to a public high school. She competes in forensics, kind of competitive acting, speech categories. But when at a tournament, she meets this arrogant guy, Feroz Darcy, who is a debater from an exclusive private school, Netherfield Academy. And he really gets under her skin. And, you know, she decides, hey, I'm going to take this guy down a peg or two. I'm going to, you know, become a debater. And not just that, I'm going to, you know, humiliate this guy. I'm going to crush him. And of course, in the process, you know, sparks fly and these characters get to know each other. And they too, you know, like the classic enemies to lovers couples, debate their way into falling in love.
Is there a bit of you in Lila Bose?
Well, you know, Jim, I didn't think so. And I think all authors, you know, put a little bit of themselves into all their characters. But my teenage children, after they read, you know, an earlier copy of Debating Darcy, they turned to me and they said, huh, this protagonist is hot-headed and passionate about the issue she cares about and, you know, has an issue kind of, you know, flying off the handle when she feels like she's being wronged. Gosh, that doesn't sound like you at all, Mom. They were kind of giving me a hard time saying that maybe I had written a little bit too much of myself into this character.
And in addition to everything else, you teach at Columbia.
So. I do, and I teach something called narrative medicine, which is all about what I was just saying, all about the role of story in healthcare.
Well, it is a fascinating voyage for the author, Sayantani Desgupta, who tells a story well, and her latest work is Debating Darcy. We thank you and congratulations on your amazing success.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I hope your listeners enjoy the book.
That's a deal. Thank you, Sayantani Desgupta. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet provide signature support for Talk Louisiana. Stay safe and stay tuned.